Now, 10 minutes after 8, just ahead of the morning show with Greg Berg, let's take a look at WGTD Sports and Weather. Major League Baseball, the Brewers are off. The Cubs beat Washington 4-3 in 10 innings. Cardinals lost to the Dodgers. So this morning, Cubs are leading the Brewers by a game and a half in the NL Central. Cardinals 5 games out in third place. The White Sox were off yesterday. The schedule tonight, the Brewers play the Pirates up at Miller Park. Cubs host Cincinnati. The White Sox are in Baltimore. NFL Thursday Night Football, Cincinnati beat Baltimore 34-23. Coming up on Sunday, the Packers meet the Vikings in a noon game. The Bears play Seattle on Monday Night Football. High school football tonight, gatewaysportsweb.org, Park and Horlick, 6:45. Over on WGTD Sports Live on our Facebook page, the Crosstown Classic, Tremper and Bradford at 7 o'clock. Now that forecast from the National Weather Service for this Friday, the 14th. Lovely day, lovely weekend. Today, sunny and warm, a high of 80. Saturday, sunny and 78. Sunday, sunny and 81. Right now, 64 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. Wind is calm, humidity maxed out at 100%. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:11, the morning show is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degree. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Newly reimagined for 2018, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. JackAndrea.com.
I'm really excited about the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show as we talk about fatherhood with a very talented writer by the name of Chris Cornelis, who is a regular contributor to the Wall Street Journal, and his writing has appeared in the Village Voice, among other places. He makes his home with his wife and children in and around Seattle, Washington. And his new book is called Rocking Fatherhood: The Dad-to-Be's Guide to Staying Cool. And in this really intriguing book, Chris Cornelis offers all kinds of thoughts on what it has been like for him to be a father, some of the mistakes he maybe feels like he made, some of the misconceptions that are out there that maybe make parenthood needlessly complicated, and in particular, really offers some interesting ideas on what the father-to-be can do to help the mother-to-be through those 9 months of pregnancy, a lot of things which may not occur to the average man, and a lot of really great observations as well about how to be a really good father once the baby arrives and the actual act of fatherhood really gets going. It's a terrific book, available now in paperback from Dacapo Lifelong Books. And Chris Cornelis, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
I really enjoyed this book. I happen not to be a father, but I nevertheless really enjoyed it. But I can imagine on a whole different level somebody who has fatherhood in their future, or maybe is even in the midst of experiencing it and not quite knowing if they're doing a good enough job, will really find your book very, very helpful. One of the things you seem especially anxious to do is to try to ease the sense of guilt and stress that seems to be such a pervasive part of being a parent in the modern world. Can you just say a word about the extent to which you and maybe your wife as well experience guilt and stress through this experience? Is that one of the primary reasons why you decided to write this book?
Yeah, it really started when my wife, Betsy, was pregnant with our first child, Thomas, which was about 6 years ago. And we noticed that there was an awful lot of pressure for her to breastfeed. and it wasn't so much supporting the choice that she wanted, but pressure to do this one thing over anything else. And when that didn't work out, there was less support than there was pressure to just keep trying. And that was sort of the first of what turned out to be many kind of musts, if you will, rather than options. And we kind of pretty quickly realized that our baby was going to be just fine no matter what we did. And as I kind of continued down the road from everything from, are we going to keep our child home full-time with one of us, or are we going to send him to daycare, or what preschool are we going to send him to, what kindergarten are we going to send him to, and as I started doing research for the book, really it kind of came into focus that we were just kind of worried about all the wrong things. And like you were mentioning earlier, that there's a, dads who might be worrying if they're doing it right. If you're, this is kind of the message of the book, is that if you're a dad that's worrying that you're doing it right, then you are doing it right.
Chances are you're going to be a good dad because you're just concerned and want to be a good dad. But
that's what the doctors and OBs that I talked to were, most of them had the exact same message to me, which was that really the most important thing is that you're there for your kids, you listen to your kids, and you love your kids. And if that's the case, then everything else is going to work out.
This is a little out of order from what I'd intended, but since you brought up the matter of formula versus breastfeeding, I actually want to just spend a little bit of time with that, although that discussion happens to be well into the book. It's actually week 25 of the 40 weeks that you take us through in the typical pregnancy. And you call this chapter, Consider the Formula. And it only occurred to me now as I was listening to you kind of talk about this that there's probably a play on words there, that you're not only talking there about formula, as in the formula that some babies eat, but also this notion also that there is a formula out there that is this strict plan to which everybody who is a good parent needs to adhere. And you're really saying that there is way too much of that out in the world, that is strict ideas about what is good parenting and what is not. And this is just one example of many.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's kind of amazing when, I just thinking about formula versus breast milk, it's pretty amazing how much is put out there, and the amount of pressure that's put on women, particularly from people who otherwise feel like women should have a right to decide what to do with their body, and don't tell women what to do. Yet when it comes to breastfeeding, it's like we're all about the bumper stickers telling you exactly what you should do.
Exactly. Explain to our listeners what happened to you, or what was said to you at the when you were at the hospital for what I think was maybe a pre-delivery tour. The way they answered a question really is what sort of set this whole discussion and concern in motion.
Well, we had, just to back up a tad, we had, Betsy had tried and was unable to breastfeed our first child. So 4 years later, when we were taking the hospital tour for our second child, Lucy, Betsy decided, okay, we're going to give this a try, but she decided she's not going to really put herself and the baby through the ringer with the lactation consultants and the whole bit. But if it works the second time, but if it doesn't, that's fine. We know we have this very healthy and safe option, which is formula. So when we were taking the pre-hospital tour, which is a very good idea to do, I asked the registered nurse giving us our tour, I said, will there be formula waiting for us in the room in case we decide to need it? And she kind of looked at me in horror, and she said, no, there won't be any in the room. That formula is considered a form of treatment, so you have to get permission from your doctor to give your baby formula. And I said, that's fine. If there's not going to be formula in the room, there's not going to be formula in the room. I will bring it myself but I don't need anybody's permission to feed the baby formula. And she said, well, let's go talk to the lactation consultants. And I was like, all right, I'm ready for this. So we walked down the hall and knocked on the door of the lactation consultants and said, hey, do they have to have permission to give baby formula? And she's just kind of like, no. If you want formula, just tell us, and we'll bring some down to your room. It's not a big deal. You don't need permission from anybody. But this is a registered nurse giving parents, you know, expectant parents the tour, the lowdown, and she got this thing completely wrong. And it kind of illustrates how much bad information or lack of information is out there on this topic.
Right. And I think beyond that, it also shows an alarming cluelessness when it comes to this whole issue of parental stress and guilt and pressure.
Yeah.
And in a sense, this moment in the hospital where you are being given this tour, you and your wife, should be all about allaying pressures and stresses and feelings of guilt, of feeling like you're falling short. I mean, the last thing a nurse or anybody in that situation should be doing is sending expectant parents on a needless guilt trip.
And I was at this point, I've already started writing a book about this topic. I mean, I've got my, and we've already been through pregnancy once, and I'm not, I don't have a problem kind of raising my hand and saying I actually see a problem here and whatnot. But if this is your first time going through this, you know, and if you had, I could just see how much worse you would feel about it.
Absolutely. It's interesting. You as you go on to kind of discuss this matter further, you kind of go on, I almost called it a rant. I think that's the wrong word. But you go on, let's say, a tear in describing just how spectacularly wonderful in every single way your first child, Thomas, was and is. And then, of course, after we're hearing about all of these, right, and then after listing all of these really, really wonderful things about him, I mean, and he really does sound like an exceptional kid, you end this discussion by saying all of this is more incredible when you consider that he's accomplished all this and at such an early age in spite of his troubled upbringing. Thomas, insert painful silence here, grew up on formula. I mean, in your mind, that's in a sense, all the demonstration you need that this matter of breastfeeding versus formula has been twisted way out of proportion to a point where it's just not helpful anymore.
It's true. And obviously, we had a great experience. You know, full disclosure to your listeners, I, too, was formula fed. So take everything you hear here with a grain of salt. But, you know, you can talk to pediatricians. Talk to my son's pediatrician. Can you tell the difference between a child that's been breastfed or hasn't been breastfed? Of course not. Nobody can tell the difference. And when you look, the really shocking thing is when you look at the studies that places like the American Academy of Pediatrics use to create their policies, and so many of them will, you look at the numbers behind them and you say, really, that's why you're making this recommendation, because you might save four cases of diarrhea over here, or, you know, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, actually, one of the most shocking things, or not shocking, but surprising things to me was when you described that experience with young Thomas, where you dutifully tried really, really hard to breastfeed. Well, that is your wife Betsy did, and it just never went very well, and ultimately, the decision was made. You say begrudgingly, we gave up and bought the Costco pack of Enfamil. Is that what
Enfamil,
you call it?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, we brought it home, shook up a batch, and noticed the comforting words placed prominently across the front of the box. Experts agree, breastfeeding is best.
Yeah.
So even on the box of formula, I mean, that has been created by people who obviously believe in formula to some extent. Here's this, what amounts to what seems like a warning, you're not doing the best thing for your baby by using our product.
It's amazing. They don't put those warnings on the chicken nuggets at Safeway, do they?
No, on a lot of other things.
But, you know, it's funny. The last time I was at the grocery store, I noticed that messaging had been removed from the specific bottle that we had been buying. 6 years ago, which was encouraging to me.
Thank goodness. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Chris Cornelis, and we're talking about the book that he has just written called Rocking Fatherhood, The Dad-to-Be's Guide to Staying Cool. I want to ask you about something that anybody who picks up your book will notice right away, and that is that it has a special foreword written by somebody named Duff McKagan, and I have to admit to not recognizing that name, but I do recognize the name Guns N' Roses, if only vaguely. So tell us about your connection to him and why his foreword is part of this book.
So Duff became a good friend of mine a number of years ago when I was the music editor at Seattle Weekly, and I was editing his, he wrote a weekly column for the paper and the website, and so I edited his weekly column, and he and I became good friends through that process. And he had two daughters, teenagers at the time, and I started, you know, when Betsy became pregnant with Thomas, you know, in our course of conversations, I would ask tough questions, you know, hey, you know, what do you think about this, or hey, man, I got this, you know, I got this, or I'm thinking about this, and he was, you know, he was just a really level-headed guy, which he just is on every topic, and was really helpful. And I was depending on how you want to look at it, either my position was eliminated or I was fired from Seattle Weekly. You know, there's many different interpretations of what went down. But when that happened, Duff was one of the first guys to call me, and he said, "Chris, what are we going to do now? Like, can we go somewhere? Can we do something together?" And I was like, "Yeah, let's do it." So he ended up asking me to collaborate with him on his second memoir called How to Be a Man. And so I wrote that with him. It came out last year. It actually just came out in paperback. And I asked Duff. I said, "Hey, you know, I talked to him about this book idea. He loves the idea. It was really encouraging." And I said, "Do you want to rewrite the foreword?" And he was just, couldn't be happier to do it. So that's how Duff ended up in the book.
And I like his foreword very much. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your career as a writer. And you say in one chapter of the book, "I got into journalism for the money."
I got it.
And say later on, "I didn't take AP English in high school or any other AP class for that matter. I was never encouraged to pursue writing, so I didn't get into journalism because I had a long love affair with the printed word or defending the truth. I'm not ashamed to admit that I got into journalism for the $11 a story the Argonaut paid me, but I loved every single minute of it." Can you tell us a little more about how you kind of stumbled into this field, which you have come to love so much?
Well, you know, I made the really reasonable decision of going to college as a music performance major to become a rock star, you know, which obviously is just like such a preposterous thing to say, but that's actually what I would tell people. It's the kind of cringes to think about that now. And I don't think I was ever really serious about that, but I was going to school to be a music performance student, and about after the first semester of school, I was 18, my freshman year, I kind of run out of money, believe it or not, from the summer job that I had had before the start of the semester, and so I was clicking around on the university student job website and saw that the student newspaper was hiring writers, and I threw my hat in the ring, and they weren't in a position to turn people down, I guess, at that point, because, I mean, I really had very little to no experience and no direction, really. It's like, all right, go out and start writing stories, and that was it, and I just absolutely loved it, and I started writing for the local paper, too, picking up stories there, and that was it. And I ended up switching my major to journalism a few years later, still kept doing music as much as possible, but I loved it all, and it wasn't until I had, you know, been writing for a decade and had been an editor several places and had been I think it was around the time that I had left or was about to leave Seattle Weekly that for the first time in my life sat down in front of a screen and wrote for absolutely no reason at all. Everything I had ever written up to that point was for an assignment, for a deadline, for something somebody else was going to see, and it was just, it was kind of a revelation for me. It's like, wow, I've never done this before. I've never just kind of sat there and typed what I'm interested in, and just for fun. And as I started doing that, I started writing a lot about experiences my wife and I were going through, and about my kids, and just the changes and the priorities of my life. And some of these raw essays or pages or whatever you want to call them ended up in the book.
Mm. By the way, at the risk of reminding you about what I know was an unpleasant moment in your professional life, I want to ask you about this matter of losing your job with the Seattle Weekly. I don't mean to talk so much about that, as you've already said.
Please.
It's kind of a mixed bag in terms of exactly what happened, but what you were told by, I suppose, your boss there is that that your position was being eliminated, your employment was being terminated, and that was that. And you had to leave the building immediately, as is often the case, and you had to head home. What I really find intriguing is the positive that you saw in that really painful moment, the way in which it that moment did not just represent a professional rupture and a really sort of scary turn for the worst in terms of how you were going to support yourself and your family, but it also brought back surprisingly sweet memories from earlier in your life. Tell our listeners about that. I find this so intriguing.
Well, you know, we kind of romanticize periods of our life when kind of everything's in front of us and we could do whatever we want. And I certainly would do that. And I used to kind of fantasize about these times when I was in college and before, right around the time I was married, when I had made several cross-country trips to Wisconsin, actually, to be honest, going out to Door County to work at a summer music camp, or going to Beloit to get married and driving home back to Idaho after that. And it felt so freeing, so liberating, and it felt just like everything's in front of me right now. I don't, you know, nothing is prescribed. And, you know, at the time I didn't really think about the fact that, you know, I didn't really know what was going to happen next. I didn't know what was going to happen after I graduated from school. But I used to think about that, and I think, man, I don't think I'll ever be in that position again, and that's kind of too bad. And then when I was laid off from the Weekly and walked back to the ferry, and I sat on the back of the ferry, started sailing back to my hometown, I was kind of just looking out at the water, and I could see Mount Rainier, and I could see Space Needle and everything. It was this gorgeous day, and it just reminded me of driving across Montana, driving out to Wisconsin, and thinking, you know, I'm back in that same position right now, and it's terrifying, but it's also very liberating. And I don't know what's going to happen next, but hey, I'm just going to try what I can, and things have worked out so far, and who knows what's going to happen next week. But, you know, it was very liberating and very exciting, and I think I just didn't, you know, when I had thought about those times before, you know, you didn't think about the terrifying parts of it, but the terrifying part was actually kind of what made it exciting. And it, you know, I started talking to a few people. Like, I talked to James Dyson, the vacuum guy, and he was telling me, you know, this was just a couple weeks afterwards, and he was telling me that, man, we were almost broke, you know, I had borrowed all this money from the bank, and if that vacuum cleaner hadn't worked out, man, he was going to go bankrupt, he was going to lose everything. And he's like, but that's okay, I knew how to build furniture, you know, things would be okay. And it was really encouraging for me just to think, you know what, that's true. It's like, if this doesn't work out, I don't know. I know how to write. I'm sure I can figure out how to put that skill to good use.
This is what you write about, those trips from Montana to Wisconsin. Each of the journeys I had defined destinations with transitional underpinnings. I had my coordinates, but I didn't know where I was going. Because of these trips, I will forever associate the vision of crossing big sky country with the unbridled feeling of freedom in the unknown. When I've called on the image in the past, a pang of longing and a shameful tinge of regret accompany it. I'm nostalgic for a time when the future wasn't prescribed. With a wife, child, and career, it felt like that part of my life was over, and that I'd never again drive into the sunset, into the bliss of the unknown. That morning, on the back of the boat, a father and husband cut off from a way of supporting his family, I felt that unique breed of excitement that I've only felt when I didn't know where I was going. I just love the way you describe that. And I just wonder, were you honest and open at the time with your wife about those feelings? Or were they even apparent to you at the time? Or is that something a little more in retrospect that came clear to you?
I certainly felt that way, you know, that day on the ferry. And but I don't think that was my message when I came home, and it was 11 o'clock and she was shocked to see me. I don't think the first thing I said was, "This is so great, because now I don't know what's going to happen." I don't think that was the first thing. But I remember I did.
Not the central theme of your news.
Not the central theme. But I remember I said the funniest thing to her at one point. I said, you know what, let's just see if I can, why don't I just spend a month trying to be a full-time freelancer? And if I can't make it in a month, who knows, I'm never going to make it, of course. That was just another preposterous idea, because it takes a whole lot longer than a month to get a freelance career off the ground. Although I had already kind of had a running start, but no, that's not the first thing that I said to her. But I certainly was, she was so supportive, and neither of us just kind of cried in our beer about it. We both tried to, do the best that we could. And I really ended up just catching what I would consider a golden parachute, and we ended up doing just fine.
Right. One last question about your writing career, and then I promise we'll get into more of the fatherhood stuff. But I'm really curious about one of the most interesting stories that you tell. It's one of my most vivid memories from the book, interestingly enough, even though it feels a little bit like a tangent, but it's a really interesting tangent. But I'm really curious why you take the time that you do to tell us the story of how you pursued what seemed at first like a sure bet, a job with Rolling Stone magazine, which of course would have been a huge big deal for you. And it's something which ultimately never came to pass, and it proved to be just an incredibly maddening experience. Well, you can describe to our listeners what I'm talking about. And I'm curious about not only kind of this story, but how it's what its place is within kind of the larger story that you're telling in your book about fatherhood. Is there a particular message that you think is part of your bigger story that you wanted to share here?
Well, when I was, all through the birth of my first son, this was what I was going to do, was to be a music journalist. And kind of work my way through the newspaper and magazine ranks, and then move on to something bigger. And our family was going to have the kind of life that we could live based on where I got a job and how much it paid and what that meant for the amount of time that I would be home. And, towards the very top, if not at the top of that, that career ladder would be, a staff job at Rolling Stone. And not long after, maybe a year after Thomas was born, I did get an interview at Rolling Stone, which was very exciting. I mean, I couldn't believe it, to get called for that. And like you say, the interview process was comical. And I talked to these guys; they were very excited. They seemed like it was going to happen, and then they just disappeared, which is not uncommon. And that turned out to be a very good thing for a variety of reasons. But, during that time, I started looking around a little bit and thinking, well, what else could I do to support my family? And I didn't get this job at Rolling Stone. Nobody did. They ended up not hiring, and they did layoffs. And I ended up, instead of going down this path that I had been for a long time, which was, okay, what job can I get, and then what is that going to mean for my family, kind of stepped back a little bit and said, well, what kind of life do we want to live? What role do I want to play in my son's life and my family's life? And then working backwards, okay, how are we going to finance that? How are we going to pay for it? So didn't get the job at Rolling Stone, and that turned out to be a great thing, because gave us a chance to readjust our priorities, and I ended up going, you know, creating this new path, this new model of being a freelance journalist and freelance writer of various kinds and author, and spending more time working from home and being able to go pick up my kids from preschool, and instead of spending an hour at lunch every day with a friend at work, you know, taking my one-year-old for a walk. And I'm not going to do that the rest of my life, but I'm so glad that that's what I've been able to do for the first part of Thomas and Lucy's life, and it's worked out for the best for us.
Absolutely. And I like, actually, as you describe this, you know, what was really, again, a really maddening experience of sort of, you know, oh, no, we're going to interview you this afternoon. How about tomorrow? Oh, and how about Monday? Well, then how about Wednesday and this and that? And just again and again and again and again. But you say every day that Rolling Stone put me off was another day they were not turning me down. I liked being in consideration for the job. And you go on to say, I liked being a contender. Anticipation is often the best part of any journey. And this was an anxiety I was not anxious to be rid of. So I really appreciate your capacity for kind of spinning things into a positive direction. I mean, that's probably something that serves you very well in, for instance, the role of father.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what happened the other day? Well, this was like a couple months ago. Lucy, my 15-month-old, I mean, she's just the best sleeper. And she sleeps 12, 13 hours a night, no problem she has since she was, you know, 2 months old, literally. I mean, it's kind of, I'm almost, you know, sheepish to admit that. But a couple months ago, or maybe a month ago, she woke up in the middle of the night just crying and crying, and I got out of bed, and I thought to myself as I was heading to the crib, this doesn't happen for a while. This might not happen again. Like, this is my baby girl, and I'm going to soothe her and put her back to sleep, and this might be the last time, so I really just tried to enjoy it, and it's sort of was one of the things that a couple of doctors told me about while I was researching the book, said, you know, a lot of parents are just, and this happens with me too, I'm not saying everybody else, but a lot of parents, they're trying to get through it, they're trying to just survive, and they said this time with a new baby is a very, very short time of your life, so try to enjoy it as much as possible, even though it can be really difficult sometimes. And that was something I was thinking about when I was heading in there. It's like, okay, not just like, you know, trying to get through this moment, but thinking to myself, this might be the last time that I get to soothe my one-year-old and get her back to sleep. And so I really just tried to enjoy it.
We're speaking with Chris Cornelis. We're talking about his book, Rocking Fatherhood, The Dad-to-Be's Guide to Staying Cool. So one thing you quite rightly point out in the chapter, which is for week 8 of the pregnancy, what to expect when she's reading, what to expect. This is a place in which you talk, among other things, about how much information is out there, and it really tends to be overpowering and sometimes counterproductive. You write at one point, one of the big differences between the pregnancy landscape for women today compared to what their mothers went through is the overwhelming amount of information available to them and forced upon them. Everyone's an armchair expert. Everyone has advice. And the glut of information available drives up the state of anxiety during pregnancy, which is naturally an anxiety-producing time for women already. So how do you see your book? And what did you do as you put this book together, given that reality that you yourself spell out? I mean, what did you want to do with this book that wouldn't just add it to this gigantic pile of books that have already been written? What did you want to do that would be distinctive and different?
Well, the majority of the books on pregnancy on the market are full of everything that could go wrong during pregnancy. I mean, that's what's, you know, watch out for this week, watch out for this. And most of these, 99% of these things are never going to happen. And they're full of advice. They're full of tips. I tried to be of as little help as possible while still being helpful. And At one point, I talked to my childhood pediatrician, and I asked him, don't you think everything you need to know before you bring a baby home could be put on the back of a 3x5 card? And he's like, absolutely. So that's kind of the thesis of the book, which is that you don't need to know a ton. There are a few things that could be helpful, and I try to and that's the message I try to get across, is that you're going to be fine, and here's some stories from my life that I hope support you in doing the thing that you want to do and living the life you want to live with your baby. But you know what? You don't need a book. You don't need the classes. They might make you feel better, and they might make your wife or girlfriend feel better, which is the really important thing. But you're going to be fine going in there.
Describe kind of the matrix of the book. I've already, I think, sort of spelled out the fact that your book kind of takes us, for the most part, week by week through the typical 40-week period of pregnancy. Explain that first page, which we see at the start of each and every chapter.
So the top of each chapter, you're right, I have a chapter basically for each week of pregnancy, and the beginning starts with like a information card, if you will, about this is what's happening to the baby, this is what's happening to your lady, and here's the reality behind the situation, which is really just kind of trying to put you in that week. Okay, this is about probably what's going on with her body and going on. You know, this is where your baby's at this week. She's the size of a lime or whatnot. And then in each chapter, rather than trying to say okay, all these things could be going wrong, or here's 6 pages on what's going on with your girlfriend's body this week. I try to use stories from my life or interviews with experts to try to be reassuring and to hopefully be entertaining sometimes to get this message across that this is a really exciting thing that's happening. This isn't a medical emergency that's going on here most of the time. This is hopefully a welcomed transition to the next phase of your life, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I have.
One thing that you point out, I wish I could find it because I love the way you say it, is that one thing you have to sort of be a little bit careful about is the way you phrase your own involvement in the pregnancy. That is, is she pregnant, or are we pregnant, or is my wife, or are my wife and I pregnant? Just talk for a moment about that, because I think that's really a trick for most fathers, is to figure out, I mean, is this her pregnancy or our pregnancy? And what should my role in all of this be?
I thought it was the sweetest thing ever. It was a little while ago. This 23-year-old that I knew, I ran into her on the ferry, and she looked at me with these bright eyes, and she said, "Chris, my husband and I are pregnant." And I just thought it was the sweetest thing. I'd never heard a woman say that before. But men get caught up in the how are we supposed to say it? My wife's pregnant. We're pregnant. We're expecting a child. These are just like the silliest arguments, but they really really sets off a lot of people. So I don't know. I mean, everybody's going to be different, and some women aren't going to appreciate a man saying that they're pregnant too, but they're definitely expecting a baby as well. And I didn't have any issues like that myself. My wife was very very much shared the experience with me and shared the expectancy with me.
One of the things I like about your book is that some of what you point out is, in a sense, obvious, but that doesn't mean it shouldn't be said, shouldn't be spelled out, and particularly when it is spelled out or expressed in a way that really grabs hold, penetrates us and makes real sense to us. I really appreciated what you had to say in week 9, in which you really call on fathers to make sure that you are really in touch with the mother and asking them what they need from you. And there's a really important reason to do that, and that's because in the early part of pregnancy, often the woman doesn't immediately appear to be pregnant. I mean, you, just at a glance, there's nothing different about her. And yet, even at that point, she is already experiencing things for which she maybe could really use your help. Yeah. Talk about that.
Well, as I said, there's a shortcut for helping your wife or girlfriend during pregnancy, which is to ask them what they need and then do it. That's the hard part. That's what I didn't always do, which was actually do it. But yeah, several of the moms I talked to, their advice to me was really try to empathize and realize that although you can escape the fact that this pregnancy is going on, she can't. And she's particularly during the first trimester, she's a lot more tired than she lets on. And what does that mean? That doesn't just mean that she's going to need more help. It means that you're going to need to step it up a little bit, even without her asking. And if your wife or girlfriend is the kind of person who really likes to keep a tidy house, she might be overdoing it to try to keep up. So be proactive, and you know, you be the one to get the vacuum cleaner out. You be the one to, in our case, you know, sniff the cat pans, and do that before she tries to do it, so you can, you know, make her feel good about relaxing and putting her feet up. And man, this was really something where through both pregnancies, I really did not do a very good job of, and so that's one where I think it really goes a long way. And you know, several of the women I talked to said too, you know. We're a lot likely to be in the mood for sex if we've been able to relax during the day rather than if we've been working and cleaning up the house all day.
Aha. I really appreciated what you had to say, actually, in the same chapter where you talk about this whole issue of she's pregnant versus we're pregnant, when you talk about what really amounts to the role of advocate that the father really needs to play. And particularly when you get into that situation of the woman actually going into labor. You write, women in labor are in the most fragile and emotional condition they will ever be in, and they need someone to take care of everything that they cannot. She's got enough on her mind and her pelvis. Talk a bit more about how you came to see your role at that moment in time.
I mean, anybody who goes into the hospital, should have an advocate and somebody who's thinking clearly and somebody who can be reminding everybody who comes in the door, she's allergic to X, Y, and Z. Oh, this has already happened. But, you know, hospitals are busy places and, they forget to do things. And nurses and doctors do need to be reminded about certain things. And they need somebody standing up for the person who literally can't stand up. And after Thomas was born, there were a few things, smaller things, that happened that I was just like, okay, next time I'm definitely just going to feel a lot more comfortable speaking up. And one of them is this crazy idea of circumcision. I was like, I literally couldn't get anybody to do it. And that was it just kind of blew me away. And that was something where I was thinking, like, going forward, or looking back on that, I just should have told somebody, we're not leaving here until this is taken care of. So you guys figure this out. But none of us are leaving the hospital until this is done. And definitely think that one of the father's primary roles in the hospital is being an advocate for the baby and mother, and having to be the band manager in that situation and not care what anybody feels like about you, but to
right.
make sure that she's well taken care of.
As you put it in one place, it's not your job to become friends with the nurses. It's
right.
your job to take care of your lady.
Yep.
That's the way you put it there. You share a lot of other bits of interesting information and advice, and one of them is around the matter of swaddling in week 17. This is where you tell us, yes, swaddling is a sport. Tell us when and how you became such a fan of swaddling and such an expert at it.
Well, there's a DVD called Happiest Baby on the Block, which I think I only recommend like three additional products in the book. And one of them is absolutely Happiest Baby on the Block. And I didn't believe that this sort of thing exists. But in this DVD, the doctor, shows you how to soothe a crying baby. And you think it's like some kind of voodoo or whatnot, but you're literally able to shush, which is like making a, you know, a loud shushing noise, and swaddle, and to turn off the cry, just like a light turns off, just like a switch turns off light, and it's just amazing. And so when I saw his swaddling technique, which is really just like a, you know, like they wrap burritos super tight, tight as a drum, and the way that it soothes baby, you know, I just became a real champion of that, and really with Thomas, I really prided myself in having a great swaddle that he couldn't get out of. And so yeah, became a, you know, that is one of the most enjoyable events in the Fatherhood Olympics.
Right.
With Lucy, as I do have to admit, that as much as I enjoyed swaddling, I for the most part used a swaddler, which is like there's some Velcro involved, and you know, it's a product that you can buy rather than just like a blanket. That makes it a lot easier and a lot faster. But swaddling is, this is one of those things where if I don't see somebody swaddling, I'm just like, oh, man, you're missing out. It's so much fun, and it's better for you.
I really appreciated the honesty with which you talked about something that was a real source of difficulty for you, and that is the matter of daycare. In fact, you tell us a few months after your first child, Thomas's first birthday, you left him with strangers, that is, at a daycare. I sobbed. Couldn't stop. And you can't really point to anything in your own upbringing or any horror stories, you know, from people in your own inner circle that should explain your aversion to daycare. But it really was, especially in the early going, a wrenching experience for you, as it probably is for plenty of parents. How did you ultimately come to terms with that?
Well, we just saw how well it worked, and that it wasn't a big deal, and that he enjoyed going to daycare. It was about 20 hours a week, I think it was. He enjoyed it. He was, you know, at the time he was an only child, so he socialized with the kids, and he just learned, and he developed a lot when he went there. You know, as parents, we often are just, oh, let me get the shoes. Let me do the shoes for you. Let me do this for you. We are doing everything for our kids. But when there's, you know, 10, you know, little ones in a room, the daycare providers, they're not going to do all of that for them. So they immediately are taught to, well, now you clear the table, clear the place for yourself. You know, put on your shoes yourself. And you kind of realize, oh, that's right. He is capable of doing this at this point. And he is able to do this for himself. Out of necessity, and then you're like, wow, this is great. So he developed a lot. It was great for the family. My wife was able to reenter the workforce and was working about half time, and it was a really great, turned out to be a really great situation for us, and it's one that we're going to pursue with Lucy too.
And at one point, as you're discussing this, you say it's a juggle and a struggle for everyone, a Rubik's Cube that changes color every time you give it a turn. In our last couple of minutes, can you say a quick word? You write about it extensively in the book, about the experience of going to concerts, going to ball games, and the way that is folded into your experience as a father and makes you think of your own father.
You know, this is my. I had a fantastic dad who just really, really took time. Who was very successful, and I mean that in a very positive way. He's just. It was very successful and was also just always there for us. And he would take the family to do things, and he would also just make time one-on-one to take a, you know, going to Mariners games. You know, baseball games is a really big deal for us to go one-on-one with Dad. And I can just remember my mom. I mean, I was young. I was 7 or 8 years old, or maybe, you know, being put on the ferry by myself, take the 30-minute ferry ride and waiting for seeing Dad on the other side and going to games with him. And those are just some fantastic, you know, memories for me. And you know, my dad never told me on those outings, like, hey, you know, this is how you behave in public, and hey, you need to do X, you need to do Y, you need to not do Z. But really, you know, as we were, you know, going through Seattle and going to these games and being in public, he was really teaching me from a very early age how to conduct myself in public.
The book is called Rocking Fatherhood. The Dad-to-Be's Guide to Staying Cool. Chris Cornelius is the author. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway grads can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to a more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers available online at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. And support for WGTD and the Morning Show also comes from Jack Andrea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. Now newly reimagined.